Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we hear about a suspenseful novel set in a down-on-its-luck East Texas refinery town that turns on its one-time point of pride, its highly successful girls' basketball team, and its star player in a contemporary witch hunt episode surrounding the discovery of a premature baby thrown into a dumpster. The Unraveling of Mercy Lewis follows the story of that star basketballer who's led a sheltered life for most of her life under the eye of a fiercely apocalyptic Christian grandmother who has been predicting the imminent rapture, especially as the year 2000 approaches. It's only through basketball that Mercy flies, but when first she, then her other teammates, develop a series of seizures and mysterious tics, the town turns on the teenage girls of the community as police search for the baby's mother. My guest today is the book's author, Kaya Parsonen, who is a first-year English professor here at the University of Tulsa. Her book, The Unraveling of Mercy Lewis, was published last year and is now out in softcover from Harper Perennial. Her debut novel, The Ruins of Us, won the Michener Copernicus Award, and The Unraveling of Mercy Lewis won an Alex Award from the American Library Association and was selected as the best book of the year by the Kansas City Star. Her work has appeared or forthcoming in the Lonely Planet travel writing anthologies, The Brooklyn Quarterly, This Land, and The New Delta Review, and Salon. She's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Kaya Parsonen, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Where did The Unraveling of Mercy Lewis start in your mind? Did it start with this idea of young girls in a town where a sort of a witch hunt mentality began? Did it begin with this relationship between this grandmother and Mercy Lewis? Or what exactly? What was the starting point for this novel?
The spark for this book was actually an article that I read in the New York Times Magazine early 2012. It was called What Happened to the Girls of Leroy, as the New Yorkers told me to pronounce it. It was all about this small town in upstate New York where 19 young women and one young man developed these physical tics and verbal tics and twitches and sort of sent the town into a panic because they thought it was some kind of an epidemic. They thought it might have been a result of some toxic element in the water or the air. And actually, Erin Brockovich came out and did all this testing, and there was all this media surrounding it. And this article was basically like, well, what is actually at the root of it? Because Brockovich's tests came back negative. There was nothing organic that was causing it. And, you know, it turns out that Susan Dominus was the journalist who wrote the piece, and she doesn't give you direct answers about what causes this mass psychogenic illness, which is, you know, would have been called mass hysteria. 100 years ago, but she sort of leads you to your own conclusion, which is that it was caused by anxiety, stress, trauma, individually in these girls. But even neuroscientists don't understand why then it transfers to other people after it develops in one. And so I just found it really compelling and fascinating. And you know, the first paragraph of the article was talking about how this family was sitting around the dinner table and the daughter was twitching uncontrollably and like grunting. And, you know, the parents were just crying because they didn't know what to do. And I thought, well, that's the story I want to tell, is about a family who's confronting this issue within their own household. And that's, I think, what was so hard about it for the parents in Leroy is that, you know, when you say that it's not something you can take medicine for, it's a psychosomatic illness, then the first reaction is, oh, you know, are you saying she's crazy? Or are you saying it's our fault, like stress and trauma? You know, we're the parents. Are you pointing the finger at us? So it sort of causes you to confront these great anxieties and fears. And now I sort of understand that even better because now I'm a parent. And so there's a lot of guilt and the strong feelings that come with that role. And so I could see why they just wanted Erin Brockovich to say, hey, it's something in the water.
Now, what I love is you took that premise and sort of turned it completely on its head, where the psychiatrist comes in and mentions psychogenesis illness, and he's just basically shouted out and ignored.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. In this town hall style meeting that gets a little rough.
Right. And you took this idea, and I imagine you sort of went through all sorts of scenarios to sort of, okay, how can I use this? And you end up in Port Sabine, Texas, surrounding a high school women's basketball team.
Yeah, well, it was interesting because with the girls in Leroy, this type of event usually begins with an alpha female of some kind. And in Leroy, it was one of the head cheerleaders. And, you know, then it passed to her fellow cheerleaders. And then it broadened out to other members
of the
community.
So just like in the same way in the novel where it's the best player on the basketball team.
That's right. The Mercy is the girl to whom, like, all other girls look and they kind of idolize her. And she symbolizes a lot for the town because it's definitely a down on its luck refinery town that suffered a deadly explosion a few years back that killed many and wounded many others. And so they look to Mercy and the team for hope and for entertainment. Certainly it's that Friday Night Lights sort of Texas sports, small town sports feel. And so the reason I chose the basketball team is because I don't know anything about cheerleading. And I played basketball in high school. I like to say we were like the hardest working losers out there. We worked really hard for every loss that we had. We definitely, our coach was tough as nails and she ran us hard, but, you know, we just didn't have the talent to get the W. But that's why I had so much fun writing Mercy, and because she was sort of the player I wished that I had been. She just gets out there and tangles with the boys on the court in summer and, you know, schools them. And she's just tough and pretty fantastic. So she was a great character, great, great fun to write.
And you know the tribe of a women's basketball team, too.
Oh, yeah.
I assume any sports team is sort of its own little tribe.
It is. And it's funny, but I actually was thinking the other day about how, you know, we really were a tribe. We were these sort of like fierce, feral girls on the court. And then, you know, we get to practice in them every morning, 6 a.m. That was when we practiced. The boys got the after school slot. So, you know, we get out there and we were just mean. We were throwing elbows. It was fierce. You know, we got black eyes. We were really allowed to kind of go crazy out there. And then we'd go into the locker room to get ready for school. And all the girls would shower and get out their curling irons and their makeup bags, and they'd do their faces and get their hair looking perfect. And then they'd go out into the school being these sweet, sort of docile, like girls, you know, girly girls. And that was always so weird to me that, you know, only on the court were we allowed to be sort of tough as nails, jerks, like take no prisoners, like allowed to exhibit all these characteristics that aren't allowed in women or girls in the real world. And there's this great line actually from Friday Night Lights, which is one of my favorite shows and books. But somebody tells the coach's wife, she's furious because they just spent all this money on a Jumbotron and she wants, you know, some money for her school. And she's just, you know, fit to be tied. And this woman says very condescendingly to her, Tammy is her name on the show, Tammy, nobody likes an angry woman. You know, like basically like you got to use your womanly wiles to figure out how to get what you want, you know. And I just think that's so funny. And I love the basketball court for that because it does away with all that, you know, frippery and, you know, falseness and just lets girls be competitors and be badasses.
Now, you grew up all over the world, I guess. You really spent a lot of time and then eventually settled in Texas, right?
That's right. Yeah, I was born.
So you're a transplant Texan.
I am.
And is there a distinct culture?
Definitely. And, you know, I finally feel like Austin and Texas are home for me. It took me a long time. I was born and raised in Saudi Arabia. I lived there till I was almost 12. And then we moved to outside of Austin. And I experienced culture shock when we moved back. And when we lived in that part of Austin, you know, it was the early 90s. We were kind of out in the hill country. And kids definitely came to school wearing their cowboy boots and wearing their big old belt buckles and hats and driving their pickup trucks. And I mean, the kids still drive the pickup trucks. But, you know, it was definitely had a real like Western feel to it. And one of my teachers, I went back recently to speak to the students there. And one of my teachers who's still there. She said, do you remember when that cow got loose in the parking lot? I was like, no, I must have missed that one. You guys took care of it before the students found out. And I love that. I've really just taken to that culture, you know, like a fish to water. I love country music and I think I love Mexican food. I think it's because I love stories. So, you know, folk music, country music, songs that tell stories. I'm all about that.
Yeah. Now, you set this book in Port Sabine, which is in that far eastern part of Texas. It's replete with all sorts of chemical plants, petrochemical facilities. I always think of that part of Texas as sort of in, you know, Austin is sort of the outlier for the state, really. But it sort of embodies that sort of feeling of, we don't need no government to tell us what to do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the employer, whatever the employer does, well, they shouldn't have done that, but hey, that's the price of having a job. Mm-hmm. And what's happened in your Port Sabine is there's been this chemical explosion. The whole town is sort of reeling from this major disaster that killed a bunch of people, mm-hmm. sickened others. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of the breeding ground for this particular story.
Yes, absolutely. I grew up, you know, in the biggest refinery town in the world, Ras Tanura, Saudi Arabia. So even if I wasn't born and raised in East Texas, I know a little bit about refinery towns. And of course, now here I am in Tulsa.
Yeah.
And previously lived in Baton Rouge. So something about refinery towns draws me to them. But I remember I was in high school, or no, it was 2005. So I was actually just out of college. And when this massive explosion took place in Texas City, and I believe it killed 15 people. Oh. And, you know, it turns out that the owners of the plant knew that it was in total disrepair, that it was just a matter of time until something deadly happened. And, in fact, there's a line in the book when Illa is given this report about the explosion in Port Sabine. There's a line in it that says, you know, the inspectors basically have written this analysis, and they've said, I've never seen a situation where the thought I could die today is more real than wow. in this plant. And that was in a report given to the Texas City refinery officials before the explosion. And they chose to do nothing about it because it's cheaper to pay off the families of the dead, and it's so cynical, than to actually maintain the plant well enough, you know, from the get-go. And so I just thought that's such tragically sort of an American story where you don't have oversight, where life is cheap. And, you know, there's a lot of poverty in these towns down there. And the people there are, they do feel like company folks. They owe a lot to the job that they have through the plant. So nobody really wants to, you know, speak up. But I think now there's actually been, you know, big backlash, and there are all kinds of movements down there by environmentalists. You know, it's really been brought to the attention of a lot of people that it's just not acceptable that this is happening in the United States. So I definitely thought that a lot of folks in that kind of an environment would be prone to thinking that there was something in the air or water that could sicken them, because it has before. So when the girls start to get sick, everybody naturally thinks, oh, it's because of something that happened at the plant. It's because of something at the refinery, when in actuality it is something very psychological and much more complex and hard to understand. So, but the idea of the being poisoned feeds the hysteria among the girls and the people in the town.
When you first went into this book, you know, the comparisons have been, you know, this is a Salem witch sort of scenario. Did you go into the book thinking that was what you're going to write about, or did it come out during the process of the writing?
Well, I remember when I read the article in the Times, and then, you know, it sparked my interest enough that I started doing some research on mass psychogenic illness, and I just thought, this reminds me so much of the Salem witch trials and what little I knew from my history classes, and of course the Crucible. And it's interesting because now historians are looking back at that episode in our history and thinking that it could have been mass psychogenic illness, very likely that kind of repressive environment for young women would have been a breeding ground for that kind of behavior and that kind of outcome and illness. So I read this wonderful book called A Delusion of Satan, which is basically a reframing of the witch trials as mass psychogenic illness. And it makes you much more sympathetic to the girls who perpetrated these, you know, sort of heinous things against other innocent people in the town. And of course, it was also driven in large part by greed, people wanting other people's land. You know, the famous case of Putnam, the Putnam family, who were the most well-to-do in Salem. And so, you know, I did borrow some names. There's the Putnams in Port Sabine. And
who ran the plant that exploded.
Right.
And is trying to rehabilitate himself out of this scare. Yeah. Mm-hmm. My guest today is Kaya Parsonen, assistant professor of English at the University of Tulsa. Her novel, which came out last spring, The Unraveling of Mercy Lewis, is now out in softcover. She's a new professor at the University of Tulsa, and it's a really wonderful book. Before we talk a little bit more about the story, one of the things I really appreciate, and I don't know if this was intentional or not, but you know, when I think of Port Sabine, I think of Port Arthur and all the, you know, all that area just off the Gulf Coast. It's, if you go out in the woods, we're talking like impenetrable, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just so, everything's fetid and growing and rotting at the same time. Mm-hmm. And there was something about your prose style, which I was looking for the right word, and I guess lugubrious would be mm-hmm. the, I mean, it's, this story really unfolds slowly. It's mm-hmm. sort of like a, one of those rivers down there that looks like it's barely moving.
Mm-hmm. I don't know whether to take that as a compliment or not, Rich.
No. But it's you know, it's fertile. You know, it's yeah. there's fertile prose to it. But you know, this really sort of unfolds slowly. And I thought that was really interesting. Was there any connection to that sort of idea of this sort of, it's a hot summer. Nobody wants to move except, you know, these basketball players are out sweating. You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's definitely a languidness to that summer scene that opens.
That's a better word.
That opens the book. And, you know, I think it's so important for an author to develop their characters well in the first third of the novel. And so I think that's a flaw in both my books is that it's a little slower. And then things really pick up after, you know, because I want people to care about these characters before things start happening to them, you know. And I just had fun. I think place is really important to me as a writer. In my first book, which is set in Saudi Arabia, The Ruins of Us, I started with place. I didn't know anything about character or plot. I just started writing about the desert where I'd grown up. And likewise with Mercy Lewis, even though I had more of an idea of the characters and plot, once I figured out that very important piece about setting, where was it going to be set? Once I realized it was going to be Southeast Texas in that swampy, you know, story-filled part of our country, problem-filled as well. But, it's unlike any place, really, with the bayous and the swamps and the huge cypress trees and there's, you know, this culture, this wonderful culture that's distinct from anything in Texas. It's a South Louisiana, Southeast Texas.
It is. Yeah, it's sort of an amalgam, but they're Texans.
Right. They've come over the border for jobs, and that's about it. But yeah. So I definitely wanted to capture that sense of the heaviness of that southern summer and the heat. Having lived in Saudi Arabia and Texas, I know a little bit about heat, and so it was easy to describe. And of
it's
course,
very different heat than Saudi Arabia.
It is very true. And so I just had some fun with that. And you know, anytime you get a kind of a gothic setting like that, where things are living and dying, as you said, simultaneously in the thick of this very mysterious sort of forest and swamp, I think it's fun for a writer to go crazy with that.
And as you noted, you do spend a lot of time at the very beginning sort of introducing us to Mercy and her grandmother, Avelia, mm-hmm. known as Mama to Mercy, and their relationship. And so Mercy's got a lot on her plate with her grandmother because her grandmother is as fundamentalist as it comes, and she's seeing visions, mm-hmm. and she's been – I'm not sure if she's been pretending disaster forever mm-hmm. or she's just been right enough for everybody to believe her or what. But you've set this right around the year 2000, so mm-hmm. you have all this Y2K hysteria going on.
Yeah.
It's not overt. It's very covert for the most part, I'd say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was interesting. In the course of my research, I found out that these episodes of mass psychogenic illness usually take place around the turn of a century. There's something about that changing over, that sort of sense of, oh, here we go. We're, you know, building to the fever pitch and we might all, you know, be taken away in the rapture at the turn of the century. There's just always been lore and stories and fear around that sort of switching over to a new age. And so particularly with Y2K, and I remember I was a senior in high school when that was all happening. And it's just fascinating that that's when this sort of mass hysteria bleeds out into the mainstream culture. And so, you know, with that going on, and then, of course, you know, Mercy's having to also absorb her grandmother's vision of an imminent rapture, which is coming at the end of the year. And so, you know, Mercy, of course, she's a teenager. She's 17 years old. She thinks, I'm not ready to be raptured. I want to win the state championship, you know, and so she's really got this strong desire to live, which I think most people do. And it's that idea of the naive, the innocent, that's very gothic. And so I definitely played with that with Avelia as sort of the very influential She's raised by her grandmother, Mercy is. And so she hasn't ever known anything other than her grandmother's sort of religion and her visions and that sort of thing.
Yeah, mother basically abandoned her, is her thought.
Mm-hmm.
And we find other reasons later in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, Mercy is the star basketball player, but at a crucial crunch time in the state tournament,
mm-hmm.
she loses her mojo for a game.
Mm-hmm.
And the town is letting her know about that.
Yeah.
Bo Putnam, what's the Crucible character, the preacher character that's
yeah.
sort of, you know, enabling mm-hmm. this hysteria that develops. You know, he's letting her know about it. Says, well, you might don't work on your jump shot, work on your mind game.
Yeah, you
got it. So it's like, it's like right in front of her that she is supposed to be the savior for the town.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they don't want to see her stumble. And I think, you know, that's also very American. We love to build people up. And then as soon as they stumble, we help tear them down. And then we love it when they, you know, apologize or get back on their feet and we help build them up again. So it's this vicious cycle. And I think, you know, adults are ill-equipped to handle that kind of thing mentally. But certainly Mercy, as a teenager who's very vulnerable, is not equipped at all. And she has never felt sort of loved. Her grandmother's sort of very hard. It's obvious she cares for Mercy and wants what's best for her, but her idea of what's best is very warped. And so, you know, Mercy basically feels that she's expected to be perfect by everybody, by her grandmother, by Bo, by the townspeople, and by her coach and teammates. And so, you know, and the coach is also this figure, this sort of authoritarian figure who even tells the girls what to eat. She gives them meal plans and she makes sure that every aspect of their life is regulated and they're not allowed to date during the season. She just wants them to focus on the game. And so, you know, Mercy's definitely under a lot of pressure from a lot of different people.
My guest today is Kaya Parson, an assistant professor of English at the University of Tulsa. Her book, which got wonderful reviews last year, The Unraveling of Mercy Lewis, is now out in softcover, and she joins us today on Studio Tulsa. As the novel unfolds, we sort of have, there's a targeting event that sort of focuses the town and sort of increases this, at first, this hysterical sort of undertone mm-hmm. in the town, and that is the discovery of a premature baby that had been abandoned. And all of a sudden, every high school age girl in the town is under suspicion.
Mm-hmm.
What was the impetus for that particular incident, inserting that into this story?
Well, it's interesting, but I feel like with the Leroy events, there was no sort of catalyzing event. These young women just began exhibiting these symptoms in what seems sort of like out of the blue to an outsider. And I thought, you know, that is very difficult to write in fiction, in a story. And in fact, my agent, when I sent her the article and I was like, I'm going to write this, I can't wait, this is going to be my next novel, she was like, well, you know, she was worried because there's no explanation for it there and there's no resolution either. But that's life. And so with fiction, you have to definitely create a structure that doesn't seem it's operating as such. So it's got to be subtle. But that definitely, you know, the discovery of this fetus happens, you know, within the first couple pages of the book. And so it is the catalyzing event that sort of sets the town on edge. And the reason that the high school girls are under suspicion is because it's discovered right across from the high school at this convenience store where all the high schoolers go. And later there's a little more evidence that also narrows the search. And I also feel that there's sort of nothing that terrifies a high school girl more, having once been one myself, than sex and its consequences, you know, and this idea of getting pregnant. You know, that's always what you're taught. Don't get pregnant. Don't let it happen. Don't even have sex, you know, and particularly for Mercy and these girls in this very conservative town.
Where the coach is saying no dating during
Yeah, exactly.
The grandmother predicting doom and gloom.
Yeah, exactly. So definitely, you know, sex is not on the table for these girls. And so rightfully, they're afraid of what people think about them if they're sort of associated with sexual activity. And certainly the book provides a sort of commentary on what I view as the terrible consequences of society's fear of young, fertile female bodies and the way that we treat those and the way we try to control the sexuality of young women. And so I think that it's not totally out of the realm of possibility that girls would react under this strain as they do in Port Sabine. And to me, it made a lot of sense that that would put the pressure on all the girls so that they would be susceptible to this sort of mass hysteria.
Now, you tell the story through two voices, and that's one, Mercy herself, and then the other, the basketball team's manager or assistant, if you will, the student assistant, Illa, mm-hmm. who is befriended fairly well by Mercy, but Mercy's other best friend on the team basically treats her horribly, and she's considered a wallflower and just somebody who's overlooked. Mm-hmm. And she is sort of the documenter of mm-hmm. everything that happens. Mm-hmm. Why that voice? Mm-hmm. For that reason?
Yeah, well, the reasons were twofold. For that reason, definitely, but also because Mercy's worldview is so narrow in scope because of how she's been raised. And so her sections are written in the first person, you know, present tense, which is about as focused as you can get in terms of a point of view, almost claustrophobic, where we're just experiencing her narrow vision of the world, or more accurately, her grandmother's narrow vision. And so we don't trust her necessarily. We like her. She seems tough. She seems honest. But because of how she was raised, we're not sure she's seeing things as they really are. And so Illa was the character who would sort of shed some light on what was really happening in the town, what was really happening with Mercy and the girls on the team, and sort of provide that commentary, and also to provide just some room to breathe for the reader as well. So her sections are in third person, you know, breaking all kinds of rules, fiction writing rules here.
That's why they're there.
That's right. That's right. But Illa, I think, does provide that sort of refreshing breath that, and for the reader to see more accurately what's going on.
Yeah. Well, it is a really fascinating book. And of course, when Mercy collapses and all of a sudden the girls go through it, you have every possible reason going through the town, from its guilt about this fetus, its environmental from the plant, it's the devil himself.
Demonic possession,
and everything in between. And you do a wonderful job of balancing and sort of depicting what happens in a sort of a hysterical situation.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. It took several drafts to get it right, but there's definitely a lot going on. And the thing about the mass hysteria is, as I mentioned, that there's no real resolution. It's not like, oh, we found the answer and now all the girls are cured. And so, you know, the ending itself, well, I won't give anything away, but it is rather open-ended in some regard. It doesn't answer all of the reader's questions. But I was sort of modeling my writing on that of Susan Dominus, the journalist, who left it open-ended for the reader's interpretation. And so I think a careful reader who's maybe emotionally identified with these girls would understand, I hope, that what was at the root of this.
And a nice little shout out to Austin's Barton Springs at the end. That doesn't give anything away, I don't think.
Nope, that's right. Yeah, one of my favorite places.
And it was apparent from the way you wrote about it, you know, this oasis out of the parched earth, you know, this cold water that just sort of bubbles out in the middle of the city. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was sort of the way you described it. It's obviously a special place.
It is. There's something healing about it, I think. And so I thought it was sort of the perfect place to end the book and, you know, show Mercy swimming in Barton Springs.
Well, Kaya, thanks very much for your time and congratulations on the book. We look forward to the next one.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Kaya Parson is assistant professor of English at the University of Tulsa. Her second novel, The Unraveling of Mercy Lewis, which has received a critical acclaim, is now out in softcover from Harper Perennial. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.